Five Talks on 5FM with Nick Hammond. Share stories, change attitudes, celebrate people, talk loud, listen loud, live loud. Five Talks on 5FM.
It's 21 Pilots called Chlorine. Hammond time on 5FM. It's 8 minutes after 11 and it's a Five Talks Tuesday. Recently, I was invited by Penguin Books to hear all the different releases that they had for 2019, and I was quite excited by one in particular called Land of My Ancestors, a book that tells an epic South African story based on true events written by Dr. Potlale Temba. And I thought immediately that I had to get my hands on this book and read it, which I did. And then after that, thought immediately that we had to get the author in studio to talk not only about the book, but her life as well. So Dr. Temba joins me now. Good morning. Welcome to Hammond Time. Thank you so much
for
taking the time.
Good morning to you and your listeners.
So I suppose just to sort of paint the picture of this book, I mean, this is something that's written as a historical novel. It's written about a point in South Africa that I think often people don't get all the complexities to and all the different things that were actually going on. But this is kind of it's the backdrop of a slave trade that I think a lot of people don't talk about, of colonialism, of the Anglo-Boer War, of the rise of apartheid, of a family in Valgevall, a family that the doctor's related to, her ancestors. But at the same time, Potlale Temba is somebody who's incredibly interesting. I mean, it's a phenomenal life story that I think would be worthwhile sharing on the show and understanding some context too. And before we get into all the incredible work that you have done with your life, I think it would be interesting. You speak about sort of being raised, coming from humble beginnings, raised in small villages, in various townships. What do you remember from your early childhood days?
You know, in the past, when I grew up, growing up in a village, you know, people were more or less at the same level, economic level, more or less. And things like poverty, and unless people are actually unable to feed themselves, were not issues, so to say. You know, like right now, poverty is more about comparisons. Some people having a lot and some people having very little. So I would say I was just a normal village kid. And I was even lucky that my father was a school teacher, earning 65 rand or less a month. And so I never went to bed without food. So for me, that is important. That put me on a higher level, not going to bed. But in fact, let me say that in those days, people helped each other so much in the village. You know, there's a concept, I think it has been used before in government, mafisa. Like if you have a poor family, that let's say the husband died and that is destitute, the family, another family in the village could give them a cow to look after. And then that is why we were more or less all at the same level economically.
Did your father put the passion of education into you, do you think?
Education for us was a means to the reinvention of the family. You know, like I say, I grew up like everybody else, but I wasn't in a real village. You know, there are villages and there are villages. I was in a community where 99% of the people who lived in that community were my relatives. And there was another big village nearby, Muruleng, Saulspoort. That was a typical village with a chief on site and everything else, the whole infrastructure of a village. So I noticed that we were different from a normal village. Ours was a different one. No chief, although some allegiance was paid to the big chief because we were in the same locality. And so I've always been aware of the difference between my community and other villages. So I was different from the beginning.
And what do you remember about the early days of then deciding yourself that you, I mean, your initial thing was you wanted to become a teacher, and that is something you
like
did.
Like I said, I didn't know then what was behind why we had to choose a certain way of life. My family, at least, especially in my father's old house, there was an unwritten rule that you don't get married before you have a profession. And so education was just almost a no choice kind of thing, you know. We had to go to school, and you had to have a profession. Some are nurses, some are lawyers, but that was the rule. And so unless you don't want to get married, you will stay until you had a profession, something like that.
And I mean, your career is one that went on to do some pretty amazing things with. I mean, if you look at the kind of trajectory that it took from here, I mean, one place in particular, I think, to sort of speak to, the fact that you became the first Secretary General of the South African National Commission for UNESCO. I mean, that must have been something that was quite, going into something like that, no one's done it before. I mean, that's quite a task.
Yes, at the time, yes, I was the first, because during apartheid, South Africa was chucked out of the United Nations entities. We were thrown out of UNESCO, United Nations Organization for Education, Culture, and Science and Culture. And so after 1994, we had to reconnect. We were reestablished. And every country has to have an office which connects the nation or the country, a country office which connects it with UNESCO. The idea being that the decisions taken at UNESCO, which have to be implemented in the country, have to be taken care of by that office. And similarly, if South Africa had things to say about anything in UNESCO, it wanted to introduce an idea, an issue, then it does it through that. And I did that.
And what do you remember as well about, I mean, having your education when you went over into the UK to study, mm-hmm. Sort of around that time, and a lot going on politically in South Africa and mm-hmm. in the world as well? I mean, how do you recollect what that was like for you?
It's actually very interesting. It was a very complex time all around, because I, at the time, was married. I lived in Atteridgeville in Pretoria. That's where we lived with my husband and children. And then my husband died in a car accident. And then I was devastated, not knowing how I'm going to continue with my life and look after the kids. And my family said, okay, hey, you're so crushed, find a way out. And they said, okay, go and see if you can find a scholarship and go and study overseas. And that's what I did. Went from embassy, not even knowing what I want to study. I remember when I got to England and in class, and the professor would say, what inspired you to study parasitology? I said, what inspired? I wasn't inspired. I just came to study it. You know, and so I then just packed up and went to England to found a scholarship with the British Council, and I went to Wales actually to start with, and they did a master's in parasitology and studied and came back.
It's an incredible story. I mean, you know, you describe it so nonchalantly, like, well, this just happened because it happened. But I mean, if you think about the context, and I mean, it's remarkable what you did at that time and then what you've done subsequently with it as well, like in the fields of sciences. I mean, there really is a lot.
I suppose, if it's your life, you have lived it, it's past, and you've gone through all the emotions that go with it.
Right.
I must say, let me put it this way. When I was in Wales in the class for the first time, I mean, I would be asked simple questions. What do you do over weekends? And we lived in a township. Oh, no, we clean the house, we go shopping and all that. And do all South Africans do that? I said, I don't know. What do white people do? I said, I don't even know one of them. That was the life I came out of. I didn't know a single one whose life I could describe. And there I was in a classroom full of students, right. Most of them white. And I'm telling you, the first time I sat next to them, I could feel my skin because I had never been in that kind of situation. Never been, never, ever. I was about, how old was I? About late 20s or something like that. Yes. Wow. And that was that. And I also didn't understand how the English students carried on because, like, we shared a house, and every morning at breakfast, we would congregate sort of in the kitchen. And as we are making our breakfast, you greet each other. And everyone says, what a nice day. Or what a bad day. I said, goodness, every day. These kids tell me about the weather. I wonder whether they study climatology. I didn't know that was the British way, you know.
Right. But it's so interesting you make that point, because when I read your book, part of what sort of, you know, you reflect on things as you read, and part of what kind of struck me as interesting is how important it is to understand how complex history is. Because when you go into the nitty-gritties of something and you really look at someone's history at a deeper level, you understand the things that brought that person to be at the place in life that they are. And I think sometimes as younger South Africans, like I'll take myself as an example, when our own history was taught to us, there's a lot that gets left out.
Yes.
And a lot that maybe because there isn't time to go back into and look at properly, but a lot that younger people don't know.
Yes.
And I often think that that's quite severely to our detriment.
Yes. I must say, part of why I wrote my book was for our kids, for our children. And because now I'm much older, I've experienced most of my life. But I felt like there are subtle things about oneself that you need to know. And if I told you you are this, or this, or this, it doesn't land as well as if I actually told you about where you come from, for example, how you became who you are, who you owe to be, to have become who you are, what is embedded in you that produces you and others of your kind. Like, I have one son, and I had two daughters who passed away. Goodness, that was another devastation. And it happened soon after I had finished, not soon after, I finished the book in 2000. It was first published as The People of Erafa in 2005. And in 2008, I experienced the death of these two girls. And I believe somehow, having written that book enabled me to take this trauma, because I saw, this is what I held on to, because I felt if they survived what they survived, I can survive this. I remember saying to people at the funeral and so on that I come from a long line of survivors. I will survive this. And so that is what I want them to know, that nothing should, you know, derail them totally. Nothing. If people could go through what they went through, they can experience anything and stand up and continue. So that's the purpose of writing the book. And thankfully, I see them very interested in it. My cousins and children and everybody else are excited. They like it, and they like what it says. And I keep saying it's just to tell you about the depth of the strength that lies in you. That's all.
I mean, but there's so much to it that is just historically fascinating that I've always taken a great interest in South African history, and there's a lot in there that I didn't even really know. I mean, to talk about sort of the slave trade that existed in the late part of the 1800s. I mean, that's I don't think that's a very well documented part of history.
No, it isn't actually. This book is so interesting because it's like there were ever so many coincidences. Like I say, I knew we were different. Me and my cousin were always fascinated by how did we get to be so different, you know?
Right.
And that was always something that I wanted to investigate. And then at the time, I just, as I said, I was working for the as a Secretary General of the UNESCO Commission, and they had the Slave Route Project, and it is an international project where it said that the history of slavery doesn't get the same attention as, for example, the history of the Holocaust. Slavery, I mean, if you think of the numbers that were involved in slavery, the slave trade from West Africa, from East Africa, from Malaysia, all over the world, the numbers that were involved. But the attention that it received is negligible compared to this. So UNESCO was trying to correct that kind of perception and to say we need to develop a slave route. Every country that experienced slavery has to have a slave route project, which would be at points where you experience slavery, you would do something. For example, in Cape Town, you have the slave lodge, the museum, the slave lodge, which documents slavery, but the slavery that of people that came from the East, Malaysia, and so on, to Cape Town through the Dutch East India Company. And then I was involved in that, and we're trying to help the implementation and to make the slave lodge synchronized to the UNESCO Slave Route Project. That is when, as like I'm saying, I have a friend who's a historian, and I was saying to her, you know, it's so difficult to talk about slavery in Cape Town because people are ambivalent or about how they should react. You know, it's like a stigma. It's like you adopt a less than attitude compared to other people who were never slaves. You are stigmatized. And I said, actually, that is wrong because it's blaming the victim. But anyway, I said, we're going to develop economic activities around the slavery so that the descendants should benefit with the emphasis that's going to, the spotlight that's going to be brought on slavery, like tourism, and if they are doing something related to tourism and slavery, and people can come and talk to them and all that type of thing. And I said, ooh, it's exciting. I wish something like that I could do the same thing in back home in the Transvaal then. And he said, no, it wasn't. Okay, whatever. And then, then she showed me Fred Morton's book. And that book describes the slavery, the hidden slavery that took place in the Transvaal after the abolition of slavery in 1834.
Right. I mean, that's that would, the historical context, I suppose, is you had the Cape Colony and the Boer Republic at the time. And,
yes.
And I think in the 1830s, they abolished slavery. But it continued in the Boer Republic slightly later. But what was going on, as I understand at the time, and what your family was implicated in, was effectively children were being taken out of communities and out of tribes and out of different villages.
Yes.
And they were being declared as orphans.
Yes.
And then from there, there was some, call it like an evil loophole in the law almost, where because if they were children, they became properties of the state to some extent, and then were able to be sold as property, which in effect was a slave trade.
Yes, exactly. Yes, because first of all, if you capture a child and you, but I mean, we were amazed. I mean, later in the epilogue, we were able to, I mean, from here, they were captured from a village in Limpopo in Polokwane.
Mm.
I mean, 3 hours from here. You ask yourself when you're an adult like that, how could anybody be captured and kept only 3 hours away from his home? But then you see at the age at which they were captured. I mean, you drive 1 kilometer with your child, say, are we there yet?
Right.
Have we arrived? You know? And so they literally were dependent on these people that captured them. And they grew up speaking nothing but Dutch, and became acculturated to that. But they were not Dutch, they were sub people, because their role was simply to work for them.
Do you remember, because I know you've said this before, and it's in the prologue to the book, where you talk about you obviously not having ever considered yourself to necessarily have been a part of a network of, that you then found out you were a part of this network of slavery, your ancestors.
Mm.
What did that feel like when you first found that out?
I was shocked, first of all, because nothing in my experience, because I grew up, let's say, on Veghofa, very independent people, very self-determining people. They were big farmers and nothing. Like, especially where you don't have a chief, we do what we like, when we want,
right,
and so on. Self-determining, if I may use that word. And nothing prepared me for that kind of information. But I wasn't surprised, because where did all this Dutch speak? We were the second generation that didn't speak, that spoke Setswana. My father's generation mixed the two, and the generation his father, they spoke, and those two generations, they spoke, I don't think it was really Afrikaans, but
somewhere between
Dutch and Afrikaans, yes. In the middle of villages of Botswana. So that was quite strange. And so I wasn't surprised. It was an anomaly that we saw, and we wanted to know how. And so, and I said, wow. But, and I didn't feel the stigma, but I think my father's generation felt the stigma, because I think people did use the fact that they are different as, why, you know, I don't know.
Like, well, I mean, human beings do that all the time.
Yeah, if you are an albino, people mock you or something like that. I think.
Other, yeah.
But it was never internalized. That was the interesting thing. That for me was very interesting, because if it was internalized, I would have got it. But what they then did, because then they were attached, they were associated with this missionary that they met, and
Goning.
They were associated. Then they took Goning's education that he brought, and embraced it and used it as a mechanism for reinventing the family. Because they were not a family when they got there. They were not just people. People dropping in for refuge. Because at a certain age, they were let out of the farms. And then these two met with Garneng and landed on Velgafar. And then elements of a family started, marriage and cattle and so on. And then they started. My grandfather was the one on whom they really pushed to get the best education. And he became a dominie of the Dutch Reformed Church. And so from there, that is the trend that emerged. And by the time I was who I am, I only saw people who were teachers, who were nursing, blah, blah, blah. But I didn't know
how it had all come to be.
Yes.
And it's this remarkable, you know, history within a history that, as you say, it was relatively undocumented. Why I think this book is so important and so interesting, but it makes me think a lot about, if I look at like modern day South Africa now, and I look at young people and as a country, and you know, we're still with a lot of problems and a lot of challenges and a lot of things that are going on, and I wonder how somebody like you looks at that and whether what sort of place you think we're in now.
Yeah, I think what my family teaches me, like I said, first of all, that you don't your survival doesn't depend on somebody else. You interpret what is happening, and either you behave like a victim, and then you are done. Your children, you are going to be crying, your children's children will be, your children will be crying, your children's children will be crying. The victim mode, I think, is the worst thing that can happen to any people. I think I appreciate the struggle to get justice, but you have to, there's a fine line between justice and becoming a victim. I think there's a saying that the best form of revenge is success. So that's what I subscribe to. I think young people of all shapes and types have to build their own future. They have to build their own future in their own conception and take what exists. I have the freedom to take it as you see it, or to convert it, or to modify it. You build what you want, the future you want. Like I'm saying, my family built the future they desired. And that doesn't mean they were rich or anything, but they got to a point where we, as the generation that didn't suffer like them, we don't carry the pain that they suffered. And that is the biggest, that's why I said, this book is a book of love and gratitude. The fact that I didn't even have an inkling of the pain that they went through, I think that kind of protection is amazing. So, we have to build a future that we want. And it is possible. This is what the book says to you. Because, you see, this book is written like a novel.
Right.
Because I had a choice of writing serious nonfiction that is a textbook. And how many people would read it from the beginning to the end? And that is what I didn't want. I wanted my kids to take it and read it from the beginning, to enjoy it. And also because I wanted to give them the feel and taste of Welgafa, I wrote it like this. So I'm just saying, it's a book of hope. Because look at how, let me just get to the point of when I finished it. I finished writing the book just for me to answer the question, how did it happen? Then suddenly, I find that my cousins, older cousins, had put in a bid, a land claim. And land claims, you know, when the government does the land restitution, according to the Land Restitution Act, to be able to have a successful claim, land claim, you have to, okay, we didn't tell people about owning and losing their farm. And you have to have evidence that you own that land.
Right.
And my cousin could tell, yes, I grew up there and I blah, blah, everything. I know my family were who I knew, but they wanted the evidence and so on and so on. And they couldn't produce it. And I understand many people in South Africa fail with their land claim bids because they cannot provide the evidence. And here I was, having spent time in the archives, in doing research, writing the book, and here it was useful to the land claim. Mm. So we joined the land claim committee, and I wrote the evidence that was required, and our bid was successful.
And I found that also a very interesting part of the book. The question of land is just more than just a space. Do you know what I mean? A place that's linked to history, and it's,
yes,
linked to a person's struggle and a,
yes,
sense of overcoming. And I thought that that's also very relevant. I mean, in South Africa now, you know, when we talk about everything, the question of land has become very important, and it's also become highly politicized. It's something that every political party has a position on, mm, one way or another.
Mm.
And I wondered, for somebody like you who's gone through that process intimately, what your perception is on the way in which the land question is debated in South Africa, and also what you, how you think it should be looked at.
Okay. First of all, as you can well imagine, Welgafal is a piece of land, 2,408 hectares of land. It's a piece of land. But land like that, it's not just land. It embeds people's histories, people's past, people's even dreams. And therefore, I think to just look at land as a piece of property where you can farm is to undermine really the meaning of attachment to land. It's a deep thing. I think if we look at it like that, then we will be sensitive in the solutions that we bring. Most people, when they claim, I mean, if you look at the removals, because you read about the removal from Welgafal there, because houses were destroyed. By the time they finished and we went back there, there wasn't even a sign that there was once a house in there. And when you think that Welgafal was not just even a place, a farm as such, it was a place of refuge. People came, they congregated there to take refuge from having lost their original homes. So the wrench was deep. And so for me, I just feel, especially for white people, if they can understand the layers of sentiment behind a land claim, then we would be more tolerant of demands, if I can put it that way. You were asking me how do the debate around. So that's number one. But number two, in my view, because I come from a really serious farming family, and I am worried about talking about land redistribution without accompanying training in the use of land. Because it would be a real pity to give good land to people and they can't get benefit from it. I really feel we need to have a situation where we train people. I have noticed a very strong attachment to certification as a sign of having been educated and trained. But we need to train people to be competent farmers. Competence should be what we should aim for. So I personally feel like there should be community colleges for farming, especially now that farming is no longer the kind of farming that my ancestors did. With climate change, there isn't as much rain. How do they deal with irrigation now that the rain is so unreliable? And so it would be a good thing for the government to establish these community farming, community colleges, and train people, anybody, not just young people, anybody who wants to farm, who wants to make a living out of, because most people have done that before, who want to go back to the land, that they retrain them, upskill them, so that they are able to do modern farming.
And I really, it's an age-old saying, but it's true. In order to know where we're going, we need to know where we come from. And that's why I've loved this book. And I do think for anybody listening that wants to fill in the gaps of history in South Africa to some extent and understand a very unique and important part of I mean, this is, you know, this starts off pre-South African Union. This starts off the notion of apartheid. It starts off before all of that.
Yes.
And it makes the case for why land is more than land very clear, and it paints the emotional complexities through the lives of actual people, which I think makes it a lot easier to digest, whether it is your own history or somebody else's, like it was for me as a reader coming from a third party looking in.
Yes.
And that's why, I mean, if you sort of tuned into this late and you're wondering what we are talking about, Land of My Ancestors is the book. Dr. Botlalo Temba has written it. Do you have plans to write more?
I hope so, yes.
But for now, this is what's out and this is what we can get. Yes. Thank you for coming and talking through some of these ideas with me as well. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for the nice interview.
It's 15 minutes before 12. We'll put this on the catch-up so you can listen to it again. Five Talks on 5FM.
Five Talks on 5FM with Nick Hammond. Share stories, change attitudes, celebrate people, talk loud, listen loud, live loud. Five Talks on 5FM.